Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Lawmakers have about 1 month left in the regular session to pass both an operating and capital budget that will win approval from Governor Mike Dunleavy. But there's a lot of daylight between some of the spending packages put forward by legislators and the stated goals of the governor. How will state leaders overcome division on perennial issues like state education spending, the permanent fund dividend, and infrastructure needs across the state? Reporters join us to look at the biggest financial and policy gaps and how they're being debated in the legislature today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. There are big needs for state spending on a wide range of concerns, but declining oil prices, a wobbly and unpredictable national economy, on and off tariffs, and the outsized demands for limited dollars prompted State House Speaker Bryce Edgemon last week to declare that the state is in a pickle. A fiscal pickle that includes an education bill that the governor has called a joke and said he would veto immediately. So far, he has not. So what does all this mean? With a month left for legislators to complete the people's business, how are state leaders getting along and where are they finding consensus? Here to help describe ongoing deliberations and clarify where the main constraints are is Alaska Public Media's state government reporter Eric Stone. Corinne Smith is an education reporter for the Alaska Beacon, and Anchorage Daily News politics reporter Sean McGuire. All are joining us from the studios of our good friends and partners at KTOO in Juneau. Welcome, all of you. Okay, Eric, start us off here. Before we discuss the big elements that need to be decided, like education funding, I want you to describe how you see the overall situation that lawmakers are grappling with. Oil prices are roiling, tariffs will make things more expensive, and uncertain economic conditions have already and could continue to greatly affect many things, including the earnings of the permanent fund. And it seems that when discussion of creating new revenue streams, people get hives about taxes. So how big is the overall problem of available dollars to current demands?
Well, Lori, I think you nailed it when you said that Bryce Edgemon, the Speaker of the House, said that we're all in a pickle. It is a tough situation the legislature is facing right now. There are more demands than there are resources to meet those demands. There are hundreds of millions of dollars in deficits, even with a status quo budget. And lawmakers don't want a status quo budget. They want to increase education funding. They want to do a lot of different things. And that is making things very difficult right now. And again, as you mentioned, I mean, oil prices are in some turmoil right now. They have been for some time. Basically, the situation is when lawmakers left last year, they thought the budget was basically balanced, maybe a little bit of a small surplus. And then oil prices have since declined. When we got the spring revenue forecast in mid-March, that was an even bigger flashing red light. Oil prices are forecast as somewhere in the neighborhood of $68 a barrel for years to come. And that means less revenue available for state spending, even on regular stuff the state has been doing for many years. Maybe we'll get to this later, but just this past month, in early April, when President Trump made his tariff announcement, oil prices fell off a cliff. They dropped somewhere in the neighborhood 10%, a little bit more than that, and they have yet to really recover from that. So this is kind of a deficit session right now, and how to solve that deficit while also achieving the priorities that the House and Senate majorities laid out at the beginning of the session. We're in a pickle.
All right. Thanks, Eric, for getting us started. We are having some technical issues. We're hoping to get those resolved soon. But Eric, if you could maybe help Sean get on the mic now. Sean McGuire with the Anchorage Daily News. You said the budget is the framing and nothing is affordable right now. How do you see this difficulty that is before state leaders?
Hi, Lori. Well, thanks for having me. And I think a way to think about it is that Alaska's legislature and Alaskans in general are really going to have to ask themselves some big questions this year and over the next few years. And some of those questions are, what sort of services do you want the government to provide? How big do you want the permanent fund dividend to be in the future? How much should education funding be? Should Alaskans raise taxes on the oil industry, on Alaskans themselves, to pay for state government and the dividend, with current revenues not being able to meet the needs or the expenditures that the Alaska legislature wants to make? If these questions aren't answered this year, they're going to have to be answered in the next couple of years because, as Eric mentioned, the revenue picture really does not look like it's going to improve in the next few years. Alaska has a savings account, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which has about $2.8 billion in it. And the thing is, that could get drained very quickly. It would only take a couple of years, and then there really is not many choices left for the legislature. So there are some really big decisions that need to be made. And again, as Eric mentioned, there's talk about expanding the budget when it comes to things like education funding, and there just simply isn't enough money to pay for what the state already provides. So there are some really big questions that have to be answered by everyone in Alaska in the next year or two.
And Eric, turning back to you for a moment before we bring Corinne in here, your thoughts about how far apart or close lawmakers are currently on major budget details, as Sean just described, a huge list of needs and not enough dollars to cover it.
Yeah, you know, it seems like the House and Senate are not close when it comes to deciding how to solve this problem. The Senate majority has been quite clear that they would like to see the revenue issues, the fiscal issues be solved by adding new revenue to the state. They have proposed, you know, three sort of major initiatives on that front, and those are basically one that would reduce oil tax credits on North Slope oil production. Another one of them would essentially expand who is subject to corporate income taxes, specifically allowing S corporations in the oil and gas industry who make more than $5 million a year, aka Hillcorp, to, you know, requiring to pay corporate income taxes. The third is one that's actually going to be on the Senate floor today, which is related to apportionment of corporate income taxes when it comes to you know, businesses that do a lot of business in Alaska over the internet, basically apportioning, you know, a corporate income tax based on that. And those, you know, could come pretty close if you add them all up. This could come pretty close to, you know, closing a budget gap. But it's not clear that they'll get all the way there. What else is not clear is if the House majority is interested in addressing those at all. At this point, the House has a 21-member majority out of 40. So for those of you doing the math at home, that is one more than they need to control the chamber. That is exactly precisely how many they need to control the chamber. If they lose one vote, they don't have it. So that is basically the situation that they're in right now. So the House is not interested, or at least, you know, key members of the House coalition have not been interested in taking up these revenue measures. I talked to House Majority Leader Chuck Kopp the other day, and he basically said, you know, this is not the year to be expanding taxation on things. And you know, was quite resistant to the idea of these new revenue measures. Maybe they'll be able to pull over some votes from the minority. It's really hard to say at this point. I mean, it does not seem like they're especially close together.
So interesting. And you know, when I hear you talking about the sort of the displeasure in this idea of raising new revenues, new taxes, even if there was a movement toward that, say lawmakers changed their mind and decided, yes, my gosh, we need these new taxes, let's vote for this, that would take time, correct? I mean, it's not like that income would be flowing into the state coffers in 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. So, like, basically the situation is Yeah, you can't raise this money instantly. Although some of the Senate's revenue measures, at least at least one of them that I can remember, would be somewhat retroactive, starting January 1st rather than July 1st. That has caused some consternation among people who would be affected by the taxes. People don't especially like retroactive taxes. But yeah, there's a limited amount of money that they can raise, if any, in the time that they have left. This year, which is I think what we're seeing House and Senate leaders sort of talk about using the Constitutional Budget Reserve, that state savings account, to sort of finish out the rest of the current fiscal year, while they try to figure out what they're going to do for the next fiscal year.
All right. Thanks so much. And we are working on these technical issues and working to get those resolved for our listeners, our audience. Thank you for hanging with us. And we're going to move to Corinne Smith now, education reporter for the Alaska Beacon. Corinne, the debate over education funding really looms over all of this. Can you give us a quick description of where we're at right now and how we got here?
Hello, Lori, and thanks for having me. Education funding was a huge priority for legislatures beginning the session in January, and lawmakers or elected officials even ran on and campaigned on raising school funding last November. So it was a major stated priority by both the Senate and the House. And lawmakers really came in with ambitious plans. They wanted to raise the base student allocation, which is per student funding, to insert that into the school funding formula, which I do want to add, Alaska's school funding formula is pretty complicated, but basically it's how the state funds school districts, and then there's certain multipliers accounting for school sizes and rural versus urban school districts. But basically lawmakers came in, they really wanted to catch districts up on inflation costs. And slowly there were negotiations with the majority and minority caucuses. There was also closed door negotiations with the governor's office around different policy changes. And the bill emerged from that, House Bill 69, both raises base student allocation and then also added policy changes. Some of those prioritized by the governor's office, including open enrollment across the state, and like things like adding grant incentives for increasing test or performance around reading. So that bill was voted on by the House and passed and moved to the Senate, where there were additional changes made. Last week, we saw this sort of like dramatic change in the bill. But basically, the governor made it clear he wasn't happy with the policy changes added into the bill. And so the Senate Finance Committee moved to strip down that bill entirely to a two-line bill, only raising the per student funding. So $1,000 base student allocation boost. That moved to the full Senate on Friday. And that bill is currently on the governor's desk now. He has promised to veto that. He said it is not sufficient for, he argues, to raise district funding without requiring policy changes that he argues would improve educational outcomes. So we're really waiting right now, basically, for a veto from the governor.
So we hear that a lot, and either Corinne or Eric jump in here. Governor Dunleavy has stayed on that message regarding what he wants for education support. He wants policies enacted to improve student outcomes. Does he cite examples of the type of policy in other state systems where he sees success?
Well, you do hear him a lot. You do hear him talk a lot about Mississippi, Basically, I'm sorry, we're having some technical issues here. So you hear him talk a lot about Mississippi, and Mississippi kind of made this turnaround when it comes to reading. And that's sort of what he talks about with the Alaska Reads Act. that's why I think, you know, you want to see, we see him wanting to boost funding for reading. But the main thing he points to when it comes to expanding access to charter schools, which is another big priority of his when it comes to, you know, the policy issues that you mentioned that he wants included in an eventual education compromise bill. He points to this study from a Harvard researcher, Paul Peterson, who put out a ranking a while back of charter school systems around the country, and Alaska's was, you know, at the top of that list. There are some questions about that, you know, study, about how comprehensive it was, about whether it captures sort of the differences in charter schools around Alaska, and, you know, whether that success is replicable in other parts of the state, and, you know, if there are certain demographics perhaps that tend towards charter schools, and that anyway, there are some questions sort of around that. But those I think are some of the pieces of evidence that he tends to point to when it comes to charter schools and reading funding. I can't say and I'm speaking off the top of my head here, and I should say that. I can't say that, you know, he talked a lot about these teacher bonuses last year. I can't say we've seen a whole lot of evidence that these would be effective, you know, evidence from other states. Of course, you can sort of imagine that, you know, a $15,000 bonus to stay in a school in rural Alaska might, you know, make you more likely to stay there. But I think that's sort of the evidence that he's been relying on for that. Although his policy preferences are slightly different this year, right? He's interested in increasing funding for correspondence students, homeschool students, basically. He's interested in several other different things. We haven't seen tons and tons of, you know, empirical evidence that these things would necessarily improve student outcomes. That's sort of where things stand on that point. Corinne, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'll add too that the policy debates really happening in the Senate and House education committees have involved a lot of testimony from school districts, students, administrators, and they really are painting this picture of schools in dire circumstances with infrastructure, deferred maintenance, transportation costs are rising, healthcare costs, and then also staff turnover. So it's been very concerning for districts, and they want to see that base student allocation funding increase, also to provide more certainty for ongoing years, to have more funding within that basic student formula, and so they can have more stability and certainty kind of moving forward. And there have been ongoing policy discussions and sort of debates, and they are amenable to a lot of these policies. I've heard from district leaders say, you know, open enrollment, school choice, is also priority at districts, but they're also concerned with school funding to provide stability, and they say for all students, for brick and mortar schools and for charter schools and homeschool students as well.
And if I can just jump back in here just for a moment. The one thing that I've heard again and again and again from these school districts and school administrators as they've testified before these various committees is that I think Lisa Parody, she's a head of an interest group around education here in Juneau, and basically the way she put it is like schools are not failing, they're starving, and the argument is that they need additional funding in order to improve outcomes, and that is really what you've heard from the majorities in the House and the Senate.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. Today, we're talking about the legislature's work on the budget and where there is daylight between what lawmakers are looking for and what the governor wants. In the KTOO studio, joining us from Juneau is Eric Stone, Alaska Public Media state government reporter, Sean McGuire, Anchorage Daily News politics reporter, and Corinne Smith, an education reporter for the Alaska Beacon. Sean, earlier, the current BSA is $5,960. The bill that passed the legislature would add $1,000 to that. One question I have is if we know how our base student allocation compares to other rural states, but also, Sean, you noted that many lawmakers might support this increase to the BSA, but say it's not affordable. Is that because they also want a certain level of permanent fund dividend, or even without the PFD considered, the deficit is just too large in their minds?
Yes, that's a good question, Laurie. So I'd say up front, I don't necessarily know how Alaska's education funding compares to rural states, but what I can tell you is that ISA, which is the UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research, they did a study into per student funding in Alaska and found that in 2023, Alaska's per student funding was 15% below the national average once you add in geographic cost factors. We all know the dollar doesn't go as far in Alaska. So I can tell you, according to ISA, according to a January report, Alaska's funding is just not keeping pace with the national average. And that's a big change from decades ago where Alaska was in the top states when it came to per student education funding. Now, the question about whether a $1,000 BSA is affordable based on the PFD or any other sort of spending, it depends on who you ask. A $1,000 BSA with everything else in the budget, you're looking at a PFD around about $500-$600, according to estimates I heard recently. And the issue there, as I talk to lawmakers, is there probably just is not the support for a dividend of $600-$700, something like that. There seems to be some sort of mental barrier, I hear from a lot of legislators, about any sub-$1,000 PFD. What we're seeing at the moment in the House and Senate draft budgets is a permanent fund dividend around $1,400, which would cost a couple hundred million dollars more in state revenue, which would make the deficit even bigger. So the dividend is definitely competing against school funding in these debates. And if I had to guess, everyone always asks how big the dividend's going to be, but it seems like it might be somewhere between $1,000 and $1,400 this year. And if that's the case, you can't make the numbers add up. You just simply can't. Either you've got to draw a lot from savings, you need new revenues, or you're going to have to make big cuts elsewhere. And it just doesn't seem like there's the appetite to make hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts to the budget.
Corinne, you reported that schools started the year with 600 teacher absences, and now teachers are getting notices that they might not have a job. Funding could still come in time to retain people, but this is a perennial event, and there must be loss every time this happens. This year, it could be worse. In your recent reporting, Lori Ruxdashel, principal of Chinook Elementary School in Anchorage and the president of the Alaska Association of Elementary School Principals, testified to lawmakers saying, "What we know is 9 out of 10 teachers hired each year are replacing colleagues who left voluntarily. More than 2/3 of teachers quit before retirement. That is a stunning number. Have you heard that schools are already concerned about how many teachers may leave or have already said they're out after this year?"
Absolutely. And what administrators have told me is that the difference between this year and, yes, school districts have been having to make cuts, budget cuts, programs, classes, elective sports for the past several years. But what I've been told this year is that with staff layoff notices going out, there's way less assurance that they can actually hire back, you know, a large portion of that, because there is less in school districts' reserves now. COVID funding really came through in federal funding supporting school districts starting in 2020, but a lot of those reserves have been spent, and now districts are facing huge budget deficits and closures. We've seen really heartbreaking school board meetings and decisions being made around school closures in Ketchikan and Kodiak, Fairbanks, Anchorage. And basically, the Kenai Borough superintendent told me they have given notices to 160 teacher and staff already, and that is based on a 680 per pupil funding boost estimate for next year. But with those staff layoff notices going out, there's no assurances that those teachers will, or sorry, with the, it's more of a notice that layoff notices are coming in May, but there's no assurances that those teachers will stick around communities and wait to see if there is funding that comes through and be hired back. I believe the Anchorage School District has said that they've given notice to 360 teachers and staff. So districts are really struggling with this shortfall and are facing, even with, like I said, the 680 per funding boost, already going to make major cuts and major, there will be major impacts for the fall semester.
Before we take a break, Eric and Corinne, jump in here too if you want to. What are the conversations in the Capitol regarding the potential cuts to federal education funds? We've heard that the governor is supportive of dismantling the Federal Department of Education. Commissioner Bishop, Dina Bishop, the education commissioner, flew to Washington, D.C. for the signing ceremony with President Trump. What are other what are the lawmakers saying about this?
Right. Yeah, so the governor has expressed support for the U.S. Department of Education being dismantled, and he's made several social media posts and comments about that, and supporting the Trump administration in that, and sort of this move to give states more control over their education policy. And from the Capitol side, you know, we've asked this question in press conferences of senators and House representatives. And basically, what's happening on the federal side is that they see it sort of as this like evolving problem that is coming down the pipeline, but it's not really clear yet what those impacts will be and what those cuts will be. And so legislators are sort of in this wait and see. And meanwhile, they do have to focus on the state side, and they are focused on the state's fiscal picture and making those hard choices for state funding. So it's difficult.
And an editorial in the Anchorage Daily News yesterday by a pediatrician and mom of kids in the Anchorage School District pointed out that the corrections budget is growing. The education budget is struggling. Corinne, we know that Alaska has for decades been at the top or near the top of the nation for rates of substance abuse and family violence. Has there been research, to your knowledge, into this as it connects to student outcomes, better understanding what children experience in the home and how that affects their ability to learn?
Yeah. Well, this has come up sort of in the testimonies we've heard from district officials and from students themselves about how the cuts to their schools and seeing, you know, favorite teachers depart has impacted students' mental health. And, you know, I have not seen recent, you know, statewide research for Alaska on this specific connection with studying, you know, Alaska students, but definitely the mental health toll is there, and administrators have testified to also like cuts in staffing for school counselors and school psychologists. Those positions tend to be cut first. And we heard the principal from Ketchikan testify to lawmakers about how there's one social worker for 500 kids in Ketchikan High School today. And the need there is just greater than what schools are able to provide. So, you know, there is a toll to this turmoil, and students are definitely feeling it, I think. Yeah.
One social worker for 500 students. That's a stunning number. We need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the state budget and where lawmakers are and where the governor is as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing the state budget. Lawmakers have about a month left in the legislative session, And there's a lot of daylight between what lawmakers are looking for, what the governor's looking for. On the line from Juneau to help us understand the context here is Eric Stone, Alaska Public Media state government reporter, Sean McGuire, Anchorage Daily News politics reporter, and Corinne Smith, an education reporter for the Alaska Beacon. So moving on to, we could spend the whole hour certainly talking about education concerns, but there are other budget considerations as well. Eric, the permanent fund got hit heavily in the stock market cliff drop a couple of weeks ago. Describe that revenue loss and what it means for trying to keep state spending within certain limits.
Yeah, so first, it's like some background here. So the permanent fund is the largest single source of unrestricted general fund dollars. Those are general purpose dollars that the state can spend on anything that they want, anything within you know the Constitution and laws and that sort of thing. But they're unrestricted dollars, and those are what dominate sort of debates. And the permanent fund is invested in a variety of different things, including stocks, bonds, private equity, private credit, real estate, various other things. So we all remember the tariff announcement from a couple of weeks ago, I think. And stock markets just totally fell off a cliff. And the permanent fund was not immune from that, lost on the order of a few percent. The markets have since rebounded a little bit, I don't have a number today for the permanent fund. But the S&P is still, it's down 5%. Or so in the past month or so. We're not immune to market turmoil here. I'll say that the impact of a market drop-off would not be immediate. It would be something that is that sort of plays into the revenue picture, but is sort of smoothed out by some of basically by the way that the state draws from the permanent fund. It draws 5% of its value every year, but that 5% is part of it's a 5-year rolling average, I believe is what it is. So if we see a sustained drop in the markets, especially a sustained drop in both stocks and bonds, and additional things like real estate and natural resources and things like that, that could be a serious revenue problem for the state going forward. The thing that I think we're most exposed to here is oil prices. Even though they're a shrinking portion of the budget, they are far more volatile than the portfolio of the permanent fund. The permanent fund is sort of designed to withstand, market shocks to a degree. There has been some debate this past year about why it's not performing as well as the S&P 500. It turns out it's not performing as poorly as the S&P 500 lately. Mm. That's sort of the situation here with markets and the impact on revenue. It could be quite serious, volatility is really the word of the day in the markets right now. So it's hard to say where things will be going forward.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment. Caroline is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for taking my call. And Sean, Eric, and Corinne, it's nice to hear you. So I've only lived in Alaska for 23 years, and the PFD is great, except when we reduce the PFD, it is really a regressive tax to the people who need it most. So is there any likelihood of the PFD or the dividend payment ever becoming a income-based benefit?
And were you able to hear the question, guests?
We sure were.
Oh, good. Yeah. Yay. Our technical issues are resolved. That's so nice to hear. So there's some history here about the permanent fund dividend, and it's already been to court over fairness and how it's applied. So does anyone ever talk about this, or have the courts settled that it just goes to all Alaskans and that's it?
Yeah, it's a good question, Lori. So I think that lawsuit and the cases you're talking about, that was really to do with residency,
yes,
about how long people had been in Alaska. Means testing the dividend, I think, would be a very difficult legislative change to get through the legislature. That would be very tough to get lawmakers to approve. I mean, from the outside, you think about it, that people on high incomes don't need the permanent fund dividend as much each year, and we hear stories that people, particularly in rural Alaska, really do need the permanent fund dividend to make ends meet. So it could be a good idea. It could make sense financially. I think politically it would just be too hard a policy to approve.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. The caller makes a compelling case, but it would be something that would need a lot of political momentum, something that would need, a real change to the way that lawmakers think about what the PFD is.
Yeah, it'd be a big fight, that's for sure. Let's stay with the phones for a moment. Leon is in Esther. Hello.
Hi. Here's another one that it's hard for the legislature to deal with, but I agree that the base student allocation needs to be increased, but the House seems unwilling to deal with the revenue bills that are on the table. Finally, after 12 years of SB 21, SB 112 has been introduced to decrease the per barrel credit from $8 to $5. And it seems like a no-brainer, but it seems like it's stuck in the Senate and the House doesn't even want to deal with it. So I'd like to hear your comments on the failure to address revenue.
All right. Thanks, Leon. I don't know that the reporters want to talk on the failure, but what are you hearing from lawmakers about any palette for this? We discussed this a little bit before the break, but any traction?
I mean, we've heard again and again from the Senate majority that they would love to see revenue measures pass their bodies. And I think we will see one or more of them come out of the Senate this year. It seems likely we might see one of them come out maybe even today, the corporate income thing. These are really tough things for the House to want to deal with, because it seems like, one of the assurances, there are certain members within the House that are not interested in increasing oil and gas taxes. I would be surprised if members of the Republican minority were interested in crossing over to support that sort of thing. The Senate majority seems to agree with the caller that we do need more. We do need to fulfill our constitutional obligation to get the maximum benefit from our resources. That's sort of how the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, Senator Bill Wilkowski, has talked about these things. They face a long odds in the House. And what we haven't talked about yet is like the governor. I would be quite surprised if the governor was willing to sign any of these. He vetoed last year. This is the one that really stands out to me. He vetoed a bill that would essentially cut rental car taxes on people who put their cars up for rent on a car sharing platform called Turo. It's like right. Airbnb, but for rental cars. He vetoed that bill, even though it was a tax cut, because basically it would, his veto message said it would, he said it would be a tax increase. So like even something that was sort of a ticky-tack tax, say that three times fast, didn't pass muster with him. I would be quite surprised if these, measures that would raise hundreds of millions of dollars would get his signature. But the governor is very reticent to talk about bills that are in the legislature until they reach his desk. It's very difficult to get him on, get him on record saying, I like this bill, I don't like this bill, even if we're just talking about a concept. The outlook for revenue measures is not especially good. I don't know if anybody else wants to add on to that.
Well, let me just ask about the House and Senate have majorities that seem similarly aligned. If they are, why is it so hard to get some of these things done?
Well, I would say, there are a lot of differences of opinion within those majorities. You're right, though, that there are two Democrat-dominated majorities in the House and Senate. And you would think from the outside, passing education funding, passing a budget would be easy because you have caucuses that are aligned. But you have to think that, yes, there are some Democrats who might want more education funding. There are some others who think, well, maybe the education funding boost doesn't need to be as much. Maybe we need to have a slightly bigger dividend. All these sort of questions play into each other, and it's all trying to figure out this balancing act. And when you look at the House, because it's so narrowly divided, because the majority only has a one-seat margin, it only takes one member saying, no, I'm not interested in these taxes, no, I'm not interested in a smaller permanent fund dividend, and they effectively have a veto on the bill, the policy provision, whatever it is. So Eric mentioned Representative Chuck Kopp being opposed publicly to taxes. He's a member of the majority. He's a majority leader. So it means if we assume that, say, all the majority members want to support new taxes, but Representative Kopp doesn't, what would be 2020? The House would be deadlocked. Mm. And that is really just one kind of microcosm of all the debates that are happening in the legislature. You know, you have 60 legislators, but they're all individuals. And, you know, you reduce the dividend. Think about it. You just sort of reduce the dividend over here, where you're going to lose support from these certain legislators. You increase education funding, you lose support from these legislators who are more worried about the deficit. So it's really these complicated policy questions. And even though these caucuses seem like they should be aligned and working together well, making the sausage is very hard.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment. Deb is in Fairbanks. Hello.
Hi. I'm frustrated to hear the permanent fund discussed. Over and over, it becomes a one issue, and perhaps is why the governor was elected again. There seems to be so many easy fixes. One is a progressive income tax. We have the highest number of out-of-state and out-of-country workers, almost 25%, and our extractive industries and oil and gas, we would capture that income from these folks that come from out of Alaska. And oil and gas bring us so little as does gold mining. It's about 4% for gold mining and about 12% for petroleum. And we won't see any results from Willow. And people are so eager to run to the trough of oil and gas, so we will get nothing for over a decade from Willow. So that's my frustration. I think there are easy fixes, but people refuse to address it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Deb, for the call. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the way forward as state lawmakers grapple with the budget on Talk of Alaska. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go back to the phones just for a moment here, and then we'll bring our guests, Eric Stone, Alaska Public Media's state government reporter, Sean McGuire, Anchorage Daily News politics reporter, and Corinne Smith, education reporter for the Alaska Beacon, back in to react to some of what we're hearing here. But let's hear from Ray in Anchorage. Hello.
Good morning, Laurie.
Good morning.
My comment was that, I recently read an article in Forbes magazine that Hillcorp had a net worth of about $2 billion when they purchased Prudhoe from BP, and now they have a net worth of around $6 billion. And in that short period of time, to jump from $2 to $6 is an obscene profit at our expense. At least half of that $4 billion jump in net worth ought to be in our state treasury.
All right. Thanks, Ray, for the call. I want to turn back to Eric, Sean, and Corinne now. Before we heard from Ray about the concern over Hillcorp, we heard from Deb in Fairbanks. And kind of against that backdrop, let's discuss what the governor is looking for a permanent fund dividend. He wants to be the full statutory PFD that would be close to nearly $4,000, $3,900. It would cost $2.5 billion, creating a nearly $2 billion deficit. Has he ever said why or how he sees the math working out here?
So this is a question that I asked him as soon as he introduced the budget this year. The first question I asked was, why are you looking to pay a $3,900, $3,800, whatever PFD with a $1.5 billion deficit equivalent to roughly half of what we have in savings? And his answer was like, I don't really have a choice. I have to follow the law. Now, he doesn't necessarily. The courts have ruled that, you know, that the PFD is subject to appropriation just like any other state, expense. And, you know, we've seen that for, you know, every year in the last, I don't know, almost a decade now. The PFD has been set basically ad hoc, basically, you know, just with, you know, varying year to year based on, you know, what the city, what the state can pay. So that is, I mean, that's that that is what the answer that you get when you ask to when you ask the governor, you know, why is he proposing a large PFD? It's because he says he has to. It's questionable, you know, whether that's true or not. But, you know, that's what you hear from him when you ask.
All right. And in that discussion, describe what happened with the House version that initially included the full PFD that the governor wanted.
Well, this is a very complicated and long story, but I'll give you the give you the condensed version. The governor had, as Eric mentioned, proposed this $3,900 full dividend, full statutory dividend, caused an almost $2 billion deficit. Representative Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat, is a co-chair of House Finance. And as a budget works through the legislative process, it goes to the House Finance Committee. They put it together and they continue debating it. At that point, Representative Josephson could have unilaterally just changed the dividend figure and put it before the committee. And then they just need a majority of the members on the committee to adopt that version. Now, Representative Josephson supports a much smaller dividend, but he didn't really think about that, that he could have changed the dividend at that point. So it went before the committee with the statutory dividend in there. And the issue was then, once that number's in there, before the House Finance Committee, this legislative committee, it then became a lot harder to actually reduce it. And there's this huge deficit in the budget. There's no one explaining how it's going to get paid for. And leadership of the House majority was saying, we are not going to send an unbalanced budget like this over to the Senate. So there was this bizarre House Finance Committee meeting last Thursday where the House majority convened this committee hearing. They had this new look budget that was going to have a reduced dividend. It would be about $1,400. And then they found out they didn't have the votes for it. So they abruptly adjourned, not before announcing that some of the majority members needed to go to Alaska Folk Festival, which was happening in Juneau, because they were going to present a legislative citation to the festival organizers. And that really, as you can imagine, frustrated the Republican minority, who felt like the process was being trampled and was just bizarre. And then we go to the next day on Friday on the House floor. The Republican minority was led to believe that there weren't going to be any budget amendments debated, and there were three Republican minority members who were absent. Well, that gave the Democrat-dominated majority the numbers to shrink the PFD. So that's what they did. On Friday afternoon, they held a vote and very narrowly shrunk the PFD over objections and howls of outrage by the Republican minority. So it's been a very tortured process to get where we are. But at the moment, the dividend in the draft budget in the House is about $1,400. And that is the number we're also seeing signaled by members of Senate leadership. But I just say to Alaskans, don't count that that's necessarily going to be the check at the end of this process. It could end up being reduced as the budget works its way through the legislative process.
Right. And I just want to underline one thing there, if I can. That vote on Friday to reduce the PFD with those three Republicans absent, if they had been there, if the three Republicans had been there, it would not have passed. It would have failed 20-20. So the only reason they were able to do that is because these three Republicans were out of town or not in the room able to vote. So that was really just a remarkable thing that happened on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of tension and drama happening in proceedings right now. In our last couple of minutes here, moving on to a couple of other things, we hear a lot about the need for school maintenance and upgrades, especially in rural districts. A rural education advocate spoke with great emotion about leaking ceilings, buckets on the floor. There are schools with crumbling foundations, mold, trouble with plumbing systems. How do the needs for rural districts stack up to what is likely going to be in the capital budget?
Well, the capital budget is not likely to be very large.
Yeah, I can tell you that it's currently being debated by the Senate at the moment. And each year, the Department of Education puts forward a list of major maintenance projects, and those get ranked according to urgency of need. And there is a long list of schools that say they need help. Last year, the legislature funded a record amount of school maintenance funding. They put out quite a lot of funding for those projects on that list. This year, they're only proposing to fund the first five projects on the list from the Department of Education. That includes new fire suppression systems in the Northwest Arctic Borough. We've heard for years, apparently, they just don't simply work, and it's unsafe for teachers and students there. So there are fixes like that that need to happen, according to the school districts and the Department of Education itself. But the issue we keep coming back to, there just is not much money. There is, we hear again and again, an urgent need, but it doesn't sound like they're going to get that far down this list of needs that schools and the University of Alaska has with a huge deferred maintenance backlog.
And also in those discussions, the perennial project spending such as road and infrastructure, in February, construction companies raised an alarm about cuts to federal funding for highway construction this summer, asking the legislature to fund $300 million in road work. What have lawmakers said about these kinds of requests?
I can tell you that's not going to happen. Basically, the issue there is that if you poured money out into these projects, it likely wouldn't make a difference for this road construction year. A lot of these funding and a lot of these projects need to be worked out a long time in advance of summer. You think you need to get crews ready. You need to get this pipeline figured out, basically, of getting the funding out to the contractors to ensure that the road construction projects happen. There's a lot of competing theories and reasonings about why there has been this alarming outlook for the road construction season. It's not just a drop of federal spending. There's also been questions about how the Department of Transportation at a state level is able to deploy projects, able to get that federal funding and get it out to contractors. We did see in the House yesterday that Representative Zach Fields, an Anchorage Democrat, proposed giving the Department of Transportation more federal funding, shifting some money around so they can hire more workers to try and get more projects out there on the street. And we have heard some discussions from within the Department of Transportation that they may be understaffed and that could be impacting how projects are being deployed. So it'll be something to watch, but yeah, I wouldn't expect anything near $300 million is going to be appropriated this year to try and get road projects out there.
And in our final minute here, Eric, you reported yesterday on the salary survey that was finally released by the state. One takeaway was that about a quarter, 28% of the government jobs surveyed pay less than the median market wage. What else should folks know about the findings here?
Well, so that 28% number is not maybe the whole story here, especially if you talk to, you know, union folks. The state has for quite a long time sought to align itself with the 65th percentile wage. So like if the median is the 50th percentile, the 65th percentile is a little bit higher than that. The idea is, you know, you might want to attract people who are better than average, right? So if you look at that number, it's somewhere around 43% of state jobs that were covered by the survey were, you know, paid less than that market rate. Some of the jobs that were especially low paid are things like economists and wildland firefighters. Yeah. Biologists. Yeah. There's a lot in there.
Need.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much to our guest today. We needed another hour to discuss all that's coming at state leaders. Eric Stone, Alaska Public Media state government reporter. Sean McGuire, Anchorage Daily News politics reporter. And Corinne Smith, education reporter for the Alaska Beacon. Thanks so much to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor, Annie Feit, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Laurie Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.